Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
And thank you for coming out on such a beautiful day. When I stepped out of the house this morning and saw our cherry trees, which we brought a little bunch in on the altar, I thought, I don't want to go anywhere. I just want to be in my yard and maybe work in my garden and enjoy the flowers. So I greatly appreciate your showing up today. So today I thought I'd like to talk about dignity. And I noticed sometimes I kind of get hooked by a word. Often a word that we use quite often. And yet I suddenly find myself pondering, what does it really mean? And I'm not alone in this. There's a famous quote by Saint Augustine. It goes something like this. He says, before you ask me what time is, I know what it is. But when you ask me what is time, I don't know. Right? I don't know. I notice the kind of words that catch me are ones that kind of flex in meaning depending on who's using them and for what purpose. For example, words like justice, integrity, worthiness, honor, virtue. These are all words that we, of course, read in the newspapers pretty frequently. And sometimes they strike me as being rather amorphous or overworked or unempirical. I'm not really sure what the writer is trying to communicate. And I'm not sure really what they mean to me when I stop and think, what do I mean by integrity? And yet, I acknowledge they're really powerful words. Words that carry values that I embrace, even when I can't really articulate those values well, or clearly, or completely. So today, I'd like to talk a little bit about dignity, because this is one I've been chewing over. And I think the spark for me of dignity reaches back several years when we were in Japan, Kate and I, and a group of 18 or so other people. And we were staying at a temple in Japan, Rinso-in, which is the temple that Suzuki Roshi came from, and Suzuki Roshi's son, Hoitsu Roshi, or Hojo-san, the abbot, is now abbot of. And for those of you who have seen him, this will make complete sense. He is a man of great dignity. And yet, he doesn't act it. And what sparked this for me is once I saw him offer incense at the altar, like we just did, I just did now, right? You walk up and people are going, mumble, 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 and it's, you know, carefully touching it, and walk back, and, you know, we tend to do it slowly and solemnly. Hoitsu just kind of walks up, takes the incense, plunks it in, and goes back and does his bows and moves on. What I could say, in a rather undignified manner, kind of a matter of fact. I mean, he's probably done this, you know, countless, countless times. And yet, he had a profound dignity that moved me deeply. So recently, it's come back to me, and I've been questioning, what do I mean by dignity? What is my dignity? And what does the Buddhist tradition say about dignity? To have dignity, to have no dignity, to act undignified, to die with dignity, to treat others with dignity, to stand on dignity, to be beneath one's dignity, to lose dignity. All of these expressions, you know, we've heard before. And dignity, just from saying those things, it seems something very precious, right? But what is it? Dignity is one of those terms that we use, and yet, at times, I'm not sure what I mean by it, or what others mean. In the West, I think, and particularly in modern times, we tend to assume that the foundation of dignity is somehow connected to control, I think. We control our life, or the events in our life. And one of the dictionaries, the Macmillan Dictionary, offers this definition of dignity. The impressive behavior of someone who controls their emotions in a difficult situation. Pretty weird, I thought. And yet, has a ring to it. A lack of dignity, especially self-dignity, seems to indicate a loss of control or a loss of authority. And I'm deeply puzzled by the ramifications of this. Can it be that dignity is just something like personal autonomy? Do the sick and dying, because they must depend on others, lack dignity? They have lost control. They have lost authority over their bodies, over their lives. Can we be bedridden, for example, relying on others to care for our basic needs, to clean us, and still have dignity or not? A few years after Kate and I returned from Japan, I volunteered at the North Shore Hospice, the Lionsgate Hospital. And one man that I had been assigned to had been a Japanese gardener. He had suffered a stroke along with his cancer, and he had lost much of his ability to speak English. Gardener from Japan, right? He's Japanese. But he could still speak Japanese. And so they knew that I spoke Japanese, having come back just from Japan, and they thought, oh, this is a good match. And indeed, we got along well. But his condition quickly deteriorated, and soon he was mostly bedridden. And whereas before he'd been, you know, up and about and been able to walk with a walker. And once when I was visiting, he needed to suddenly use the bathroom, but there was no nurse around. And although volunteers were not supposed to do this, I helped him hobble over to the small bathroom in the hospital room. And after he used it, I helped to clean him. And he looked at me as I was gathering toilet paper. And he said, with a chuckle, peanut butter in, peanut butter out. And at that moment, he presented me with a kind of dignity that I had not recognized before. And the awkwardness and the embarrassment slipped away. We could say my Japanese gardener displayed a dignity unaffected by loss of control, loss of authority. Another view of dignity is to understand it as a kind of intrinsic quality, part of our human nature, or our inherent worth. And this, I think, partly comes from the work of Kant, but any rate, in the Cambridge Dictionary, it offers this definition of dignity. the importance and value that a person has that makes other people respect them or makes them respect themselves. So definitions like this describe dignity as the fundamental moral worth or status belonging to all people equally. And what's interesting is this is a relatively new definition of the word. Before the mid-1800s, the English term dignity, which comes from the Latin root dignitas, did not mean the inherent worth of a person. Rather, it meant the social status of the kind associated with nobility or power or advancement within the church. Dignity suggested at that time merit, earned or unearned. And of course, we still have the term today like dignitaries, right? Referring to people considered to be important because of their rank or because of their office. So this relatively new understanding of dignity as the intrinsic worth of a person and of all people is perhaps one of the reasons, I think, for the kind of horror that we feel at the atrocities and conditions of those caught in deep and very pervasive suffering, the wars, famines, etc. We acknowledge, consciously or unconsciously, a connection of something shared. Those people are not just those people. And so for me, this raises the question, what is it within us that establishes this intrinsic worth, this innate connection? What really is the heart of dignity? And can we cultivate our awareness of our own dignity? And can we nurture the ability to recognize, nurture our ability to recognize the dignity of others? I think this is hard in this day and age. Because first, we need to deeply question our collective attention that's so focused on wealth, power, fame. How do we do this? The early Buddhist texts from the Pali Canon, these texts recognize the pain of the human condition. After all, it was Siddhartha, the young man who later became the Buddha. It was Siddhartha, fully seeing the pain of others, that sparked his own search, according to the myths that we have about the Buddha's life. We all experience suffering, and we all spend much time trying to avoid it. However, according to the early Buddhist teachings, unlike the other sentient beings that we share this universe with, and in the Buddhist traditional cosmology, this includes the devas, hungry ghosts, animals, and the denizens of the hell realm, human beings alone have the potential for awakening. We all, according again to the early texts, have the capacity to take up this human endeavor to awaken. It is, in a way, our kind of birthright, according to the Pali Canon. Despite all the inner and the outer limitations that we're subject to, the Buddha taught that we all possess, in each moment, a degree of inner freedom that allows us to choose our next direction and thereby change ourselves. Our suffering confusion, and discontent are what motivates us towards awakening. And of course, they're also what can lead us deeper into delusion and despair. It's a double-edged sword. So looking at my own life, the moments of clarity when I was free to really choose, they were pretty rare at first. You know, as a teenager and a young man, kind of acting many times out of impulse. But I believe the potential for really choosing wisely was always there. Increasing the frequency and depth of those moments of awareness to choose, I think, is the purpose of the Eightfold Path, the Noble Eightfold Path, as found in the first discourse, the first teaching that the Buddha gave after his awakening. Now, the Pali texts call this path or this way of awakening Arya in Pali, which means noble, because it develops the awareness of the intrinsic dignity of human life from the Buddhist point of view. That's why it's noble. So rather than a life lost in the push and pull of desires and aversion, think teenagers and young men in their 20s, the Buddhist path opens us to recognize and embrace our moments of freedom. Freedom to choose how we will respond, how we will act. I suppose, if we can choose that, is a kind of control. So this does reflect, at least to some extent, the first definition I talked about dignity. However, this is not about control of the body, and it's not about the control of the conditions of our life. Even the Buddha suffered greatly. When he was an old man with cramps and bloody diarrhea and near death, he gave his last teaching using his own body as an example. He said, look at this, look at me. It is the nature of all formations to dissolve. His dignity was beyond the dissolution of his aging and sick body. We cannot be free from the sufferings of old age and sickness. They're simply part of the human condition. But as the Buddha taught, we can respond from our place of dignity to whatever life presents us. The practices and teachings of the Eightfold Path are about meeting our afflictive emotions and suffering rather than being ruled by them. And also, the teachings are about cultivating qualities like joy, equanimity, wisdom, and compassion. I think in early Buddhism, the potential for awakening is the source of human worth and dignity for oneself and for others. And that's true even if we are completely unaware of the potential for awakening. It is still there. And I think we might say that the Noble Eightfold Path and the other teachings show us the way to actualize our dignity, to bring it forward. This intrinsic dignity of human life is present in all. To disregard it is to lead a life of self-indulgence. A focus on oneself and a disregard of others, or a life of pain and struggle. Because we're always caught in comparison with almost everyone else. Why me? He's got it so good. And don't we see that often in those smallest ways, like who's got the bigger piece of cheesecake? If dignity arises from each person's intrinsic worth, then it cannot be taken away. It cannot be broken by the actions of others. It cannot be diminished even by our own self-contempt. Remember Nelson Mandela, who spent 27 years in prison and yet emphasized reconciliation as soon as he was released. And remember, perhaps you've read about the Tibetan Buddhist monk, Paldin Gyatso, who endured 33 years of torture in one of Tibet's most brutal Chinese prisons. And yet after his escape, he often spoke with compassion for those who tortured him, saying, "These people are caught in a system that encourages such actions. They exist because the system urges them to be that way." And maybe you've heard of Ani Pachin, the Tibetan nun, who survived 21 years in a Chinese prison. And when asked how she felt towards her guards, she said, "I felt terrible for those who imprisoned me. In jail, I simply took on their suffering. I took on their pain." And there are many, many, of course, more famous people maybe we've read about and we could talk about. But there are also people who are not famous, like my Japanese gardener, who teach us about the inherent dignity that we all have and the dignity of others around us. And I wonder, looking at you right now, who you might have in mind. A person of great dignity. The Zen tradition is full of stories that bring our attention, I think, to this innate dignity that we all possess. And here's one, because what's a Dharma talk without a story? Here's one attributed to the great Zen teacher Hakuin Eikaku, he was a Rinzai teacher, lived in the middle of the 1700s, and perhaps was one of the most influential Zen teachers in all of Japanese history. He kind of revived the Rinzai school of Zen Buddhism from a long period of stagnation. And because he really focused on the rigorous practice of koans. And all Rinzai teachers today trace their lineage back to him. So, anyway, he's quite a guy, lots of stories about him, as you can imagine. So this is a story found in a book called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones by Paul Reps. One of the books I read about Zen when I was just a wee lad that deeply influenced me. And I actually met Paul Reps once, library in Calgary. It was me and about 10 or so what I felt were elderly women who were probably in their 40s who had gathered. I was the only guy. And I think I was 14 at the time. And Paul Reps was great. So here's the story, as told by Paul Reps. The Zen master Hakuin was praised by his neighbors as one living a pure life. A beautiful Japanese girl whose parents owned a food store lived nearby him. Suddenly, without any warning, her parents discovered she was with child. And this made the parents angry. She would not confess who the man was, but after much harassment, at last named Hakuin. In great anger, the parents went to the master. "Is that so?" is all he would say. And after the child was born, it was brought to Hakuin by the parents. By this time, he had lost his reputation, which did not trouble him, but he took very good care of the child. He would carry the child on his back as he did his takahatsu, his begging rounds. He obtained milk from his neighbors and everything else that the little child needed. Sometime later, the girl mother could stand it no longer. She told her parents the truth, that the real father of the child was a young man who worked in the fish market down the road. The mother and father of the girl at once went to Hakuin to beg his forgiveness, to apologize at length, and of course to get the child back. Hakuin was willing. In yielding up the child, all he said was, "Is that so?" Now, there is much we could say about this short story, and which is probably apocryphal. I don't think it really happened, but who knows? But for now, let's just notice the absence of humiliation. No loss of dignity. No sense of shame. Or reactive anger. Or shaming by Hakuin. What allowed him to meet the challenging conditions of his life? In later Buddhist writings, in this Buddhist tradition, the preciousness and uniqueness of life is continued to be honored. As human beings, we have this special quality about us. For example, in the Nirvana Sutra, I wanted to give you this interesting quote, kind of echoes what I mentioned a bit earlier. "It is rare to be born a human being. The number of those endowed with human life is as small as the amount of earth one can place on a fingernail." Imagine all the earth in the world, right? That's the privilege of being born a human, according to the Nirvana Sutra. However, in addition to this basic understanding of the rarity of human life, in the Mahayana schools, of which Zen is one, these kind of later schools of Buddhism, they came to view this potential for awakening to include all beings, not just human beings, but all beings, and refer to this potential as human nature. Buddha nature. And they describe it, let me describe it a bit like this. I'm going to give you a modern quote by the Dalai Lama, which I thought was quite charming. Dalai Lama said, and this is unedited, "Every sentient being, even insects, have Buddha nature. The seed of Buddha means consciousness, the cognitive power, the seed of enlightenment." That's from Buddha's viewpoint. All these destructive things can be removed from the mind. So therefore, there's no reason to believe some sentient being cannot become Buddha. So every sentient being has that seed. So we should celebrate, right? We all have this seed, according to the Dalai Lama. And who could not believe the Dalai Lama? The Mahayana teaching is that all sentient beings, without exception, have Buddha nature, the inherent purity and perfection of the mind or consciousness, unaffected by the changing mental states that we experience. And this Buddha nature is the ground of all being. Sharing this fundamental aspect, then, there's no reason to consider oneself better than others, nor any reason to think for oneself inferior or lacking. However, this awareness of Buddha nature is usually obscured by the kind of endless chattering thoughts that go on in our minds. And yet, I think we all awaken to it at least for brief moments in our life. Perhaps when we see a newborn child, perhaps when we rest a bit in the forest after a long hike, perhaps when we deeply listen to music with our whole body. There are moments when our awareness of the Buddha nature comes forward. The sixth Chinese Zen patriarch, Huineng, expressed our human situation like this in this text known as the Platform Sutra. The patriarch said, "Good friends, you already possess the prajna wisdom of awakening. But because your minds are deluded, you cannot understand it by yourselves. Good friends, Buddha nature isn't different for the ignorant or the wise. It's just that people are deluded or they're awake. When people are deluded, they're ignorant. And when they wake up, they become wise." Dignity, from the Buddhist point of view, then, is universal. And not something that we learn or something that we earn. It is simply the shared ground of our very being itself. The Zen teacher Thich Nhat Hanh calls this interbeing. And as we look closely at the Zen tradition, this shared ground is expanded even further to include all things. Dogen Zenji, the Japanese monk who brought Zen from China to Japan in the 1200s, wrote this: "Grasses, trees, fences, and walls demonstrate and exalt the deep, wondrous Dharma for the sake of all living beings, both ordinary and sage." So in this way, we share dignity, we share inherent worth with all things, sentient and unsentient. And like a compass or a GPS, I think dignity points us towards our true home. Suzuki Roshi wrote this. Well, he didn't write it, he probably said it. Someone else wrote it down for him. We practice our way not for ourselves and not for others. We practice our way for the sake of our way. There is no reason why we practice our way. Pardon me. There's no other reason why we practice our way. We just want to go back to our home. As a duck wants to return to water. Like a traveler who comes back and lies down in his own bed. That's why we practice the way. Now, you may not agree with my take on dignity. So perhaps I've tried to shoehorn a Buddhist view into a Western word, and maybe that doesn't quite work for you. And yet, I hope that this will start you thinking about the inherent worth of yourself, of your fellow beings, and of the sentient and unsentient life that surrounds us all. Dogen tells us in the Tenzo Kyokan instructions to the cook, treat your utensils with courtesy. Isn't that beautiful? Treat your utensils with courtesy. If we accept the inherent worth of all, however we understand and experience it, then we have no choice but to go out and engage with the world, a world that is, in a very profound way, simply ourselves. Now, I'd like to make a little brief detour, make a distinction between pride and dignity. Sometimes we use the word pride when we're happy about someone else's accomplishments, right? Like a mother or father telling their daughter who scored a soccer goal, "I'm so proud of you," right? But I think that's really more like a kind of what we may call sympathetic joy or joy in the accomplishments of others. The other sense of pride, that kind of personal pride, is kind of like pride that says, look at me, look what I did. And the problem with this is it fails to recognize that you yourself did not achieve anything in isolation. Only with the help of others did you achieve anything. That's the problem with pride. It cuts you off rather than joining you too. So true dignity does not ask us to be aloof or separate. And there's nothing passive about dignity either. Dignity asks us, in fact, I think demands that we bring forward our whole life to be upright and offer what we have to the world, because the world is us, to borrow a advertising phrase. In our tradition, to act from dignity, perhaps, is to live our bodhisattva vows. So let me ask you, where is your dignity? Is it within your hands, or is it in the hands of others? Are you intimate with the form, texture, color, and strength of your dignity? Can you see the dignity of others? And as Dogen admonishes us all, please study this carefully. Well, thank you for listening, everybody.